Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Sydney Silverman with us. He's the author of A Happy Life from Courtroom to Classroom. He graduated from Colgate University in 1954 and from Columbia Law School in 57. And until his retirement in 2001, he tried major stockholder cases. And in 2007, he earned an MA with a concentration in philosophy from Columbia University. And he and his wife, Irene, live in New York City. And let us say, Sydney, hi, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you, Michael. Would you mind if I make a few corrections?
Oh, please do.
I graduated, indeed, with a master's in philosophy, but it was in 2011. You're right.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. It was the back of your book.
Then it's got to be right.
Wait, don't sue me. We'll be okay. Hi, Sydney. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Okay, now let me ask you this. And for all of the years that you've done what you're doing, have you seen major changes in lawsuits, the way corporations are run? And I'm not going to get political with you, but, you know, all of the things that we're looking at today, the debates, et cetera, have you seen a trend towards moving to where we are now, or did it just kind of happen to us?
Michael, it didn't just happen to us. We're in an age now where there are money addicts. And by money addicts, I mean they're the counterpart of alcoholics. They are as obsessed with money as a wino is with wine. And we saw what happened in 2008 when the credit freeze started and the Great Recession set in. And this was all due to greed and excessiveness on the part of banks, investment banks, and mortgage brokers. By the way, I wrote a novel about this, but called What Money Can Buy. And as a lawyer in corporate derivative cases, I developed the sixth sense. I could smell fraud. And when the market collapsed in October of 2008, the whiff was there, and I knew it wasn't the poor people, the blacks, the Hispanics, who got the subprime mortgages who were at fault. I knew what happened, and I wrote my novel about it. And so that's a second book in addition to my memoirs.
Now, by the way,
do
you have a website where we can find all the books at?
I beg your pardon?
Do you have a website where we can find the books at?
No, I don't. But they're at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and other internet bookstores. And you can also get them at your own shop if you ask for them.
Ah, okay. Now, by the way, you're 10 years older than I am. And so I went back, you know, when you were graduating college, I was in just going into junior high school at the time. So you got a good 10 years on me. But I was back there in those days, and I saw a major change, and I watched it gradually transition to whatever greed has become today. And I know you've probably seen a tremendous amount in court, but one of the things I think is critically important was when it was time for you to retire, you didn't just quit. I think a great example of what can happen to people, remember the movie with Jack Nicholson about Schmidt? Did you see the movie?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't remember it.
It's okay. It was a movie about a guy who had been a very powerful corporate manager, a CEO, and then he retired. And when he retired, Sidney, it was over for him. His identity had been left with the company and the management and all the things that he did. You see, you've taken the other road here. When you retired, you created a brand new life. You went out and you learned and you did things. And I would venture to guess that your identity stays right with you. You haven't lost a thing.
Micah, one of the risks of retiring is a mild case of depression sets in.
Yeah.
Your world is over, you think. And there's nothing left for you to do. And that I confronted. And I will tell you that if those people on the verge of retirement become socially engaged, talkative, and most important of all, find activities that they enjoy and plunge in head first, they'll kiss that mild state of depression goodbye. And I guess that was the theme of the movie that you were mentioning, though, as I say, I never saw
sure.
it.
Yeah, and if it happens and you do see it, you might enjoy it. He went the opposite way of you. But there's a point here that in all of the things that you've done and where you are now, it's age. And I feel this way very strongly. I don't think I'm ever going to be more than 14 years old. And for however long I live, until the day I die, I guess that's the way I'm going to be. But age in and of itself, there are too many people who are frightened to death of their own age.
Well, it's true, but you know, the answer to it can be found in Plato. Plato said there are different stages in a man's life. And what you have to do is recognize the different stages. And when you get to be old, I don't like euphemisms, so you won't hear me using the word seniors. But when you get to be old, you have to act your age, and you have to do things suitable for your age. But you know what, Michael? There are so many worlds open to you. You have fewer demands on you, lots of free time, and you can indulge in all the things that you really wanted to do when you were hard at work and much younger. And is there life after retirement? You remember that line, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus?
Yes. Yeah,
well,
sure.
Yes, Virginia, there is plenty of life after retirement. All you have to do is take a good, deep drink.
Yeah.
Of life, not of booze.
I heard where you were going with that. No, it's very true, because when you really come down to it, Sidney, there are so many people who their identity is wrapped up into the profession, and once that's done, they don't know what to do. And you can't tell a 30 or 40-year-old, somebody, a 50-year-old today, that if you don't do it now, it's not going to get done. You know, I mean, if you think back, you blink your eyes and you were in high school 2 seconds ago. It goes so rapidly that most people don't get that. And if you won't take full advantage of it now, it can be too late and not to be able to take full advantage of. Yes, you get older. Yes, there are certain areas that you don't get into. But at the same time, quote unquote, and you say it here, you act your age, you know, as you go. But that doesn't stop you from becoming all that you can be at that time.
Well, you know, when I say act your age, Michael, have you ever seen an old man without money married to a young, beautiful woman? Of course not. What the young, beautiful women love is money. They don't love the old man. And the old man would be much better advised to find a woman of suitable age who's attractive and loving and fine, and he'd be happier than escorting around a young woman who's only there because he has money.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and no question about it. But when you really take a look back over your life, and if you had something that you would have done over, what would that have been?
Michael, I would have put myself on the path to become a judge. There's a definite career path for that. You clerk for a judge, you work in the U.S. Attorney's Office or as an assistant D.A., and then perhaps you go to the Solicitor General's Office, you find a political mentor, and you can become a judge. I'll give you a story. When I was young, I belonged to a men's health club. It was in the basement of the Woolworth Building. That won't mean anything to you. But the Woolworth Building in 1908 was the tallest building in the world. Anyway, there was a dry steam room, and it was lined with beach chairs. And when you went into that steam room, naked, of course, you took a sheet, spread it on the wooden beach chair, and stretched out and sweated. Judges were also members. And very often it happened while we were stretched out on a beach chair, a judge walked in naked, carrying a sheet. All the lawyers got up and said, good afternoon, Your Honor. And the judge would say, be seated. And we would get back. And that illustrates that in the law, the judge is the king, is the ruler. Oh, to be a judge, Michael.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And today especially. We're starting to run out of time, Sydney. Again, where can we buy the book at? Where can we find you? Where can we find out more about what you do?
Well, I don't have a website, and I don't plan to have a website, but the book, I have two books. One is a novel that's just out in July. That's probably why you don't have it. And it's called What Money Can Buy. And it explores the great recession that occurred in October of 2008. Hmm. But it does it in the way that that I did things as a lawyer. I always believed that a lawyer was a salesman, and that to sell his client's cause, he had to use the same strategy as a life insurance salesman or as a shoe salesman uses. Make it simple, make it understandable, and package it. I did that in my novel, and I worked for 2 years on it, went through seven drafts, and I've been pleased when people have said to me, for the first time, I understand who the villains were that sank our economy, and that's the novel and the story that I have in What Money Can Buy. My other book, A Happy Life, I did enjoy my practice of law. I really loved it. I reveled in it. And that comes through, some people have told me, in my book. That recounts my cases and then my years in graduate school when I got, as you correctly said, a master's degree in 2007. My attempt to become a master at chess, and I failed. But that's another story. And it's the kind of thing that people have said to me, I give your books to dear, I buy your books and I send them to relatives who are retired or on the verge of retirement as an inspiration to them. And I append a note, you see what this fellow Silverman did? Now you get out of your rocking chair and you do something.
I love it. The bucket list, the bucket list. Sydney, we're just about out of time. I'll tell you what, I would love to have you back on when the second book comes out. Get a hold of Radio Susie, whoever your publicist is, and I will bring you back on. It would be a great interview, and I really appreciate all the time you spent with us tonight.
Michael, thank you so much. Goodbye.
Okay, take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be.
like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Hillary Madsen with us, licensed clinical social worker, provides individual and family therapy for victims and perpetrators of domestic violence in the Salt Lake City area. She's a spokesman for SAVE. That's a leading victim advocacy, I can say that word, organization. Her pathbreaking work with male victims of partner abuse has attracted national attention. Hillary, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi. Well, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we look at abuse. We know there's a tremendous amount of abuse. There always has been. And as the economy gets worse and the culture gets confused and people are looking for answers, they end up taking it out on their partners for whatever reason. And we've heard of female abuse for so long, but you're bringing something to the fore that most people really don't address. Male abuse. You know, how, quote unquote, does a man get abused? And I think let's start with that. How does a man get abused? Why haven't we heard about it before? And why are we just looking at the issue now?
Okay. So in answer to your question, I actually, I could hear you okay, but the sound wasn't too good. So I hope
How about, is this better?
Yes, that's a little bit better.
Okay.
So
well,
in answer to your question, do men get abused? Absolutely. They get abused in the same ways that women get abused in an intimate relationship, whether that be physical violence, verbal abuse, emotional, financial, and even sexual abuse. So this does happen to men, and it has been happening all along. Why it is difficult for people to come forward and talk about it is definitely multi-layered. And one big reason is exactly you're asking this question. A lot of people don't see it, don't recognize it as abuse, and oftentimes don't really know how to respond to a man who might be indicating he's the victim of domestic violence.
Okay, now, by the way, you say something very interesting. Can you hear me okay now?
I can actually just barely hear you. It's still just a whisper, but I can make it out okay.
Okay, well, wait, let's do this. We can fix that very quickly. Seth, if you can hear me, ramp up the volume, and we should be able to do that. Okay. Are we getting better?
Yes, I actually can hear you a lot better now. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. We have a visit. We have an angel over the equipment, so Seth takes care of this stuff. Now, you said a couple of very interesting things, and a couple of those, it could be emotional, it could be financial, it could be any number of different abuses. Normally, when we hear abuse, Hillary, the first thing we think of is physical abuse. But you're bringing up an interesting point. There's a tremendous amount of abuse that people may be getting, and they don't realize, they don't put it into the category of abuse, and then it gets looked over.
Exactly. And I am the Utah coordinator and a volunteer for SaveServices.org, which is an organization that is dedicated to educating the public about the reality of domestic violence and helping services for all victims of domestic violence. In fact, Stop Abusive and Violent Environments is what SAVE stands for. And one of the things that's really important is to recognize the different forms of abuse. But even in the realm of physical abuse, oftentimes, if you ask a man directly, as a therapist, I do counseling for domestic violence victims and perpetrators, both male and female. If I ask a man in an assessment, have you ever been the victim of domestic violence, using that exact sentence, 9 out of 10 men will honestly answer no. And they really think this. So I don't ask that question anymore. What I do is I ask, have you ever been in a relationship with a woman where you were hit, punched, slapped, scratched, pinched, shoved? I go through the physical list, and an alarming number of men say yes. And yet when I ask them, do you realize that this is a form of domestic violence? They're like, oh, no, she was angry, and I had it coming. I hadn't been listening recently, and I was not as attentive, and some of the same things I hear from women who minimize the abuse they experience from men, which is, no, he's really not like that, you know, he just had a rough week, the same kind of language.
So it's okay to get hit, is what you're saying?
Well, it's often the man's perception that it's not real abuse.
Okay.
Women clearly know that domestic violence and abuse perpetrated upon them is not acceptable, and there are laws to protect women and children now that I think is a wonderful thing. And the Violence Against Women's Act, which started out with a wonderful purpose and goal, which is to stop violence and to stop people dying in these violent relationships, unfortunately created a system whereby women were the only ones seen in society as victims. And SAVE is working really hard to change the Violence Against Women's Act to the Partner Violence Reduction Act. So it will include services for all victims, because as we have discovered, and there's lots of research to show, there are plenty of male victims. In fact, one National Violence Against Women survey reported 835,000 men are assaulted each year by their intimate partners nationally.
Yeah, no, I'm sitting back and listening to these numbers, and I think what's critical.
And yet we don't have any shelters for men to go to.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that has to do with culture and what's acceptable today. And doesn't that start with how they model after how they handle things, how they model after how they deal with their anger? And that comes right out of the family. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have today is family has lost its potency. The family, for the most part, is impotent. If you give a child consequence today, and we'll build this into the domestic violence, but if you give a child consequence today, you could have that child taken away. There's child enforcement.
You're bringing up a very important point. And yes, yeah. As a therapist, for years I taught anger management courses and court-ordered even parenting courses. And oftentimes this was the frustration I noticed, that a society used to have very strict, fairly strict, I would say, gender roles for men and women. You knew what was expected of you in dating roles, in relationship roles. This is, you know, our grandparents' era. And then there was a dramatic change in social values and social norms in this country, which brought about wonderful things and lots of diversity and a better understanding of the human condition. But we did not then put in place a parenting protocol that was dealt, you know, specifically to teach people to be nonviolent. We just criminalized it. We told people, you cannot spank your kids, but we're not really teaching them how to set healthy boundaries and what the alternatives are, and a more positive way to discipline. And so
let me jump in for a minute. We don't have a new one
in place that's being taught.
Yeah, well, let me hold you up for a minute. I want to take you back to an era that it was completely different. And I was brought up in the 50s. I went to grammar school, junior high school from 1954 to 1960s when I graduated. Different world. Okay, now in those days, I was a scrappy kid. My mom was 5 foot tall. If she weighed 100 pounds in those days, it was a lot. But the hair on the back of my neck still stands up if I think about walking into that house and using a four-letter expletive. You just didn't do it. And I wasn't worried about getting beaten. It was just, that was mom, and that was the end of it, and you didn't do those things. She said it, and it was over. Yeah, I got whacked a few times, but I didn't walk away bloody, and we didn't call the police. We got up, and we did what we did. There is a bond that parents and children do not have today. And I don't even know what to do about it anymore. I mean, thank goodness that I don't have a teenager, because I definitely would be in jail.
Oh, well, and it's sad that a lot of society is sharing your same sentiment. Oftentimes parents will come and for a session, and they will talk about, you know, how frustrated they are that they cannot speak their child's language and that they can't communicate what their needs are. And there is something to be said about accountability and about having healthier relationships. And I must say that the domestic violence movement, I think the goal and the direction that it was aiming for was for people to have healthier relationships and for the family to function healthier and to reduce harm and injury and murder. And all of these problems that happen because of domestic violence, it affects all areas of people's lives. And especially children that are raised in a domestically violent home, they often, almost 50% of them, grow up to be in some form of an abusive relationship.
Well, let me ask you this question. When we have to define, we have to define what an abusive home is. I do not believe, and let me say this right up front, I don't believe in beating a child, and I don't. But at the same time in this world, and I say thank goodness I don't have any kids that age, that I think a good quick swat in a rear end, there's nothing wrong with that. There's consequences for actions. Now, I know I could go to jail for that, and I know that that's something that you couldn't do. But the problem is if there are no consequences, these kids get away with everything. And look what's going on today with the shootings and the killings and the dropouts and the rest of it. They're not afraid of their parents anymore, and I think that in and of itself is a major problem.
Yes, and I do think that if we were to encourage people to use physical discipline more with their child, that would actually exacerbate the problem and not fix it. I agree that there isn't this accountability. And having taught parenting classes, the research actually reveals it's not that children are so fragile that if you spank them once, you'll scar them for life. No, that's not what the research reveals. What it revealed is physical discipline is ineffective in changing behavior, so why do it? So it's not more of a bleeding heart thing as much as it is just pragmatism. When you physically correct a child, they don't learn what they're doing is wrong. They learn how not to get caught. And what they have found is that children will find ways just not to get caught doing that behavior. They don't learn the lesson that you're trying to teach them. So I think actual discipline is nonviolent and a lot more effective. And a lot of parents are not following through with three verbal prompts and then, you know, consequence.
Now, by the way, Hillary,
right,
this
not
is
falling
the same
through with consequences.
Yeah, but that's the same thing of having a kid walk in and using the four-letter expletives. I would still, to this day, there would be no way that a child in my house would talk to me that way. Because if they talk to me that way and if they get away with that, look what happens as they grow and they become, you know, they go out on their own, they go into their own professions, etc. Those things follow through. We are in a world today, my goodness, I wish I had the answers to it, but these kids are, for the most part, they're totally uncontrolled. They think what they think without any critical thinking behind it. And I've listened to them, and they're scary because it's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know. And there's nobody can do anything, and they know it. There is a problem with that, too. There's got to be that homeostasis, that balance that's created in such a way that there are guidelines. You don't step across
And what I teach parents that are having a breakdown in discipline in their home, and actually the ones that have resorted to finally physical violence after, you know, being frustrated with grounding and all other attempts, and they will come exasperated and come in and say, you know, we can't even if we spank them, you know, which is still in the legal limits here in Utah, even if we have spanked them, it still doesn't stop their behavior. And this is where I explain to parents one of the hardest things to learn about discipline. No discipline in the world will work unless you have a positive relationship with your child.
No question.
They have to trust and respect you. And if they don't at all, even a little, no amount of discipline will be effective. They won't respond to it. And so you have to work on repairing that positive relationship, showing up in their lives, modeling healthy behavior. A lot of teens, they'll come and talk to me about how their parents rag at them for this and this, and yet they're guilty of the same thing. So the four-letter words, right? Model healthy behavior. Model it's like to have a better vocabulary. And have some very significant consequences that everyone knows about. If you say a four-letter word in this home, you will lose the privilege of being on the cell phone for 72 hours, which will put a teenager in serious withdrawal. If you've ever seen a teenager been denied even 30 minutes on their cell phone, it is torture for them.
No, Hillary, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So as we're talking about teens, and teen violence is actually on the rise in dating, and it's on the rise for boys being the ones that are most affected. Girls actually initiate violence more, according to a recent study, than boys. So we need to educate people that it's not okay to hit a girl, it's not okay to hit a boy. And SaveServices.org is the organization that stops abusive and violent environments. You can get on, you can be a volunteer, you can help with the campaign of changing domestic violence to include services for everyone, and having the real statistics out there acknowledged.
Sounds good to me. Hey, Hillary, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, certainly. It was a pleasure. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. If you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. Gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kathleen Fullen with us, the author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School, How a Few Simple Lessons Transformed 9 Culinary Novices into Fearless Home Cooks. She's a writer, a journalist, been that for 20 years now. Her first book was the finalist in the Washington State Book Awards, and she serves on the board of directors for the International Association of Culinary Professionals. And let us say, Kathleen, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me here.
And where were you 25 years ago when I got divorced? I didn't know how to cook.
There I was. Well, I would have been happy to help you out.
No, there I was with a refrigerator and didn't know what to do with it. Do you know how many people
I think a lot of people have that issue.
Yeah. And then realistically, there's so much that you can do, and I don't know a whole lot, but there's so much that you can do that most people have no idea, and they end up eating garbage when you don't have to.
Well, I think that what has happened is that we have all been sold this idea that, well, it started with Fruit Loops being part of a nutritious breakfast, as far as I'm concerned, and it kind of escalated from there. But, I mean, I think that, you know, we're kind of sold this idea that cooking isn't worth your time, that, you know, cook as quickly as possible, get in, get out of the kitchen, and there's nothing wrong with preparing a quick meal. But I think what we've done is really reinforce this concept that, you know, one of the most fundamental aspects of sort of human existence, which is feeding ourselves, is maybe something best left to companies and corporations to feed us, you know, from that toaster pastry in the morning to whether or not you stop at fast food for lunch. And then, you know, you order in a pizza or, you know, you put something in your microwave for dinner. All of that is really acceptable behavior. And I think that one of the things we have to do is really take a look at why do we eat and what's the purpose of it? I mean, yes, eating can be pleasurable, but at the very, you know, kind of core of it all, I mean, food either is part of the solution or it's part of the problem. And a lot of people don't learn to cook, therefore put themselves at the mercy of having other people prepare their meals for them. And I don't think that, you know, I've done a lot of research and I don't see anything that would dispel the notion that the correlation between obesity and, you know, all of these health concerns that we have that are so widespread in our society, a lot of them are very directly related to when people stop cooking or cooking as often as we used to.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems is, and I think what really runs into most people, what most people run into, if I said it backwards, is the time frame. It's like there are a few things I can cook. I'll glaze your eyes and make your mouth water. But that's not everything. But those things, they're time consuming. And if you run a fairly busy schedule, you know, all of a sudden you hit the end of the day and something else starts and you turn around and you didn't cook it. So is there a solution to that? Is there a way that you can cook for yourself, get all of the healthy benefits out of it, and yet at the same time have the time to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's at the heart of the book is actually this project in which I found, you know, a group of people and I went to their houses and looked at their fridges and freezers and asked them about cooking and watched them make a go-to meal and then gave them 10 weeks of cooking lessons. And one of the things that I came across after doing that and following some of these people for up to a year is that one of the skills we really lost, not just cooking, I mean, you know, a lot of people can figure out how to get through a recipe, but it's planning. And I think planning is a really key part of it. I think that, you know, we live in a society that basically you can have anything anytime you want it. I mean, more or less. Like, if you want a burger, you pull up to the side of the road. I mean, the food that you see that, you know, when you're driving and it's instantaneous and all that great stuff, and like, I want something now. And I think that with a little bit of planning, I really think that's the thing that's missing. I mean, yes, you can make, you know, braised, you know, pork or something, and that can take 2 or 3 hours. But otherwise, you know, most stuff that even you would make out of a box, whether it's a, you know, some of those kits that help hamburger and things like that, I mean, if you plan ahead, they don't take any longer to make than they do out of a box. And
if you're going to, say, get something like a frozen meal, if you make some extra, you know, portion it out in the individual things and then put it in your freezer, it's just as quick, and you know what's in it. It's going to be healthier, and it ultimately will be cheaper. It's actually a much more economical way to cook. But I think that that concept of planning and really thinking about our food and treating it as something important is one of the key things we've lost.
I learned a very valuable lesson probably, I would say, 20, 25 years ago. There were three of us, and we were having a business meeting, and we were sitting in a restaurant, and we ordered hamburgers. And it was three of the guys. And we ordered hamburgers, and we're talking and doing whatever we were doing. And one of them, one of the guys looked at me and said, "Do you know what you're eating?" Because he was eating a salad. I'd ordered a hamburger. He said, I said, "Yeah, I'm eating a hamburger." He said, "Not really." And we were in the winter time. It was in Fairbanks, Alaska. It was about 35 degrees below zero outside of the restaurant. He said, "Here, follow me." So he grabs my plate. We walked outside. He stood over the hood of his car and he squeezed the hamburger, and all of the juices ran out of the hamburger. That great stuff, that, you know, that good tasting stuff. And when it hit the hood, it turned into icky fat. And I thought, is that what I'm eating? And for the most part, when you're running out into a lot of the restaurants, that's what you end up eating. And what you eat is going to be, it's going to determine whether you're going to be healthy or not healthy.
That's exactly right. And actually, you know, there's a lot of research that's been done, and a lot of it that's really coming out now about plant-based, you know, lifestyles and things like that. But you know, you don't have to become a vegan or vegetarian necessarily, but a lot of it is just really thinking through, like, wow, you know, this tastes good, but why does this taste good? I mean, a lot of our food has been engineered to taste good to us. I mean, I have a friend, it's kind of a harrowing piece of information in the book, actually, but he started out as a chemist. And he really genuinely wanted to find a cure for cancer. I mean, I think there's a big reason why he went into chemistry. But he got diverted into becoming a food chemist. And now he works for a big company. And, you know, one thing he says, he won't eat any processed food. And he won't eat, he also doesn't eat a lot of commercially raised beef either, kind of back to your point. But he doesn't eat any processed food, and he doesn't let his kids eat processed food. And one reason he said was because, you know, the way that they approve food additives is individually. And so nobody really knows how all of them interact. You know, he says, you know, we are the mice. I mean, you can feed, you know, stuff to mice, but you really don't know what happens to it when it goes into your system. And I think that that's one thing that we don't really consider. When you're eating something, say, fast food, you're not eating just a hamburger. You're eating a lot of other stuff that is involved in that, and that's from what has been added to the bun to give it greater sheen and shelf life and to make up for the fact that they took out all the fiber. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes in the hamburgers that is a lot more than beef, and the same thing for, you know, even chicken nuggets. I mean, I just was looking at an ingredient list for chicken nuggets at one fast food company, and it has 42 different ingredients. I mean, there should be chicken and bread, and you need something to dip it in to make the breadcrumb stick.
Of course.
And that's about it. I mean,
I totally agree with everything you're saying. I'm very, really careful with what I eat, except for one thing. I'm one of those kind of people, I got to stuff myself to keep weight on. So once a day, they're over in the store, and I have no idea what's in it because I won't look at the back of it because I'm afraid of what's in it. But they have a burrito, and it's got 720 calories. I eat one of those and something else that's got a lot of calories in it. And for the most part, everything else, I'm very careful about what I eat. But you're absolutely right. Why spend hundreds of thousands of dollars at the doctor's office when, if you eat the right foods, you might not have to do all of that because it'll cause your system to work the way your system is supposed to work.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, your point is a really good one, too. I mean, I think that, you know, it seems like we have really conflicting messages in our society. I mean, there's sort of this whole everything has to be local and sustainable and, you know, whatever. But I just think find a place between Tuna Helper and Top Chef that you feel comfortable in that is the healthiest that you can cook based on your individual life. But I would just tell anyone who's listening, the next time you go to pick up a box, I mean, boxes are a big problem. I mean, and I'm not talking about, you know, boxed actual food, like, you know, like pasta or something. I mean, whole grain pasta is fine, but, you know, no. Tuba Vidoni has three or four ingredients. It's really pasta. But I'm talking about those ones where you pick it up and you can tell, like, there's this massive, like, paragraph-long, you know, ingredient list, and you don't know what half the stuff is, and it all sounds like some sort of chemistry experiment. I mean, those are the kinds of things. And really look at that box and think, what is this really trying to do?
Yeah.
One of the, you know, one example I give is my whole book was spurned by this woman I met in a grocery store. And I saw a cart, and it had all these boxes in it. And they were all like all those, you know, the center aisle stuff that everybody knows is kind of, you know, you hear is bad for you, but they seem so much more convenient. They seem less expensive. But one of them was called pasta parmesan. And I actually didn't understand what it was supposed to be. So I called the company, and it turned out it was supposed to approximate the flavor of pasta tossed with some olive oil and some Parmesan cheese. And it had 28 ingredients.
Yeah.
I mean, it had like two different kinds of corn syrup, two or three different kinds of sodium. I mean, you know, it had MSG. I mean, it just had this whole litany of all this stuff. And I just think, wow, it's amazing that food marketers think we're that dumb. You know, we can't like boil some pasta and put some Parmesan and some olive oil together. And I think everybody has that within them. And so a big message of the book is really think about what you're eating and really try to, you know, take back your kitchen one meal at a time. Even if it's, you know, you cook one more meal a week that maybe you might have otherwise have let a company feed you.
I just opened the book, and on page 45, it's got research studies have found that an increasing number of American children may get enough food to eat, yet remain undernourished due to an over-reliance on foods that are high in fat, salt, sugar, yet lack the fundamental nutrients. And it's basically, it's what you're saying. You can stuff yourself, you can be full, you can eat enough, but you may not be getting the proper nutrition.
Yeah, and it's a really good point, and I think that that's a really, I think kind of is the crux of why so many Americans really get frustrated with their weight. I think that when you're satiated when you get enough nutrients, like your body kind of knows what to do with, say, real food. But when it runs into things it doesn't really understand, which is a lot of chemicals, for instance, because we weren't really designed, you know, I mean, Grok wasn't out in the caveman era coming up with polysaturated soybean oil. I mean, so our bodies don't really understand how to deal with that. And so when you feed your body a lot of things that are also maybe even engineered to make you eat more, which is one of the things that has happened to our food, it takes longer for the satiety to hit you. And so therefore, you eat a lot more and you consume a lot more calories. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from.
No, absolutely.
And that happens to kids a lot. Kids get really addicted to junk food. It's like it's scientifically proven. I mean, they want chicken nuggets and they want like hot dogs and they want pizza because the salt, the fat, the sugar hits this like literally the sweet spot in their brains and they crave it. That's why they don't want other food. And it's one of the things I think parents struggle with that scene, you know, of I only want this and I only want that. And it's really, I think a lot of it is because they unwittingly, kids become addicted because the stuff that's on children's menu is all that kind of stuff.
By the way, interesting point, and we won't belabor it, but you're dealing with brain chemistry. You get told something, and when you do eat it with those kids, it comes out of the limbic system, a little shot of dopamine, the feel-good stuff, and they do even more. But it's all advertising. It's good. Look at the overweight issue that we have in this country today. It's mind-boggling. And at the same time,
yeah,
it has to do with, you know, stuffing yourself with all of these things that you shouldn't be eating in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that what's so interesting about it is that we don't talk enough about home cooking as a solution for this. I mean, I think people are like, oh, get kids to move, you know, do this and that. It's like, you know, actually, just start cooking. Start really actually to learn how to cook. I mean, it's a huge it's a huge problem. I mean, a lot of people believe that we are about two generations away from really knowing how to cook. And there are obviously people who are avid home cooks who are good at it. But I've interviewed so many people now, not just the people who are in the book, but who really struggle with it, that they, you know, don't feel confident. They don't really know how to shop. They don't know how to plan. I mean, I think that some of these skills that we, you know, like our grandmothers and our mothers and some of our fathers, my grandfather was actually an amazing cook. He was a cook in the Army. And, you know, that those that didn't necessarily make its way down, you know, to sort of our current generations. People are my age. I'm in my 40s. And, you know, and definitely it's becoming much more difficult for people in their 30s and their 20s where, you know, their mothers worked outside the home. It was convenience foods were something that was, you know, meant to be convenient. But the problem is that convenience foods come at a cost that I think we don't necessarily think about. And it is difficult, I think, for a modern consumer because the food environment is so complex. I mean, it's very difficult to navigate. And it doesn't help that as, you know, a society, we actually help to underwrite things like Twinkies, and we don't necessarily pay to underwrite broccoli. So it's cheaper to buy things like Twinkies, but, you know, it's more expensive to buy vegetables. But I think that, you know, if you really want to be thinner, I mean, the more you cook, the less you weigh. I mean, this book could have been called that because that is totally true. The more that people cook at home, the less they have incidences of diabetes, the lower their weight, that they may tend to make healthier choices. I mean, as long as they're not cooking from Paula Deen cookbook.
By the way, I don't know if it was in Seattle or San Francisco, but I think it was back in the 60s. Do you remember the guy who shot the mayor? Or you heard about it? The guy who shot the mayor?
Yes.
And got him off. Because he ate Twinkies, and the Twinkies caused him to have a mental block, and he walked with it. So when we talk about Twinkies, things like that, there's some devastating effects.
Yeah, it's called the Twinkie defense, and actually, it's really interesting. There are a lot of instances of violence at fast food outlets. I kind of ran across it during the research for the book. And I think, you know, people would literally show up and, like, they wouldn't have Whoppers or something, and people would freak out and, like, get, you know, incredibly violent. And you know, you think about that, and you think that's in grown people. Imagine what happens, you know, to kids. I mean, I think when you feed your kids a lot of fast food, you know, it's really problematic. And a lot of the foods that they would like, say, for instance, chicken nuggets, I mean, they're pretty easy to replicate at home. It just, again, it takes planning and, you know, and it does require messing up your kitchen a little bit. You know, I mean, it's not, you're not taking it out of a box. You're not putting it on a plate. Yes, you're going to have to wash, you know, a pan or two. But in the end of the day, I mean, food is not meant to be some super experience. I mean, it's meant to nourish you. You know what I mean? It can be pleasurable. But what's more important than, you know, nourishing yourself and your kids and the people around you?
Yeah, and I think something would remind everybody if you had a T-shirt that said, "Don't mess with me, I just ate a Twinkie."
Oh, my gosh, that's a great idea. Yeah. I love that.
We're about out of time, Kath. We're about out of time, but there is one thing that cooking will also do. If you do not have a hobby, if you're working and you're thinking that, well, you know, if that's all there is to life, go cook with somebody. There's a bonding process through the cooking also.
Definitely. Yeah, and if you don't know how to cook and you feel really unsure in the kitchen, I mean, you may not have time to, like, take a class and go somewhere, but, you know, you can go to actually my site, which is KathleenFlynn.com, and I actually partnered with somebody to do an online cooking school, and they're very thorough, and you can do it in your own time, and literally you can learn how to cook at your own kitchen counter, and, you know, you can even get a free knife lesson. Once you learn how to use a knife, it all gets better from there.
Okay, you said Kathleen Flynn too fast. Where's the website?
I did. So it's KathleenFlynn.com, and it's KathleenFlynn.com. And they can also find it if they search on the Kitchen Counter Cooking School.
I love every second of it. Hey, Kat, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you again. This has been delightful, and I, you know, I'm going to, you know, argue with you about rights that T-shirt idea because I think it's brilliant.
Oh, thanks. Take care.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Delia Posse with us. She's the author of Winning the Toughest Customer, The Essential Guide to Selling Women. She was inspired to found Woman Certified. That's a female consumer research company. After her battle with breast cancer, after her diagnosis, she saw four doctors before she found one that she was comfortable enough to see for the treatment. Many of her hesitations were due to lack of what she felt was quality care. Now she hopes to share her experiences with women throughout through certified women. And 2 weeks ago, the company kickstarted this process by releasing a list of the top 100 hospitals for patient experience. And let's say, Delia, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, that's a problem with so many people. They get a debilitating disease. They get something like cancer. Obviously, you have to be frightened when you get that diagnosis. The second question is, or the first question is, where do I go? Because everybody does not have expertise in that particular area. What was it that caused you to really take a look at this issue? Because, you know, some of the things that you went through, to do what you've done with this.
You know, it started with a devastating experience. I had gone to a doctor, you know, like lots of women, felt a little lump, went to the doctor, you know, had a biopsy, and he was, you know, he was so bad at patient, you know, what they call bedside manner.
Yeah.
He was so poor at that, but yet he had a reputation of being a leading expert in the field. And, you know, imagine being in recovery when a doctor comes up to you, looks down at you, now you're like in this fog, and says, I told you it was cancer, and then walks away. Okay, picture this happening to a 42-year-old woman who's never had any, you know, cancer in her family, you know, has three small children at home, and then a doctor walks away. And he had to prove a point because my husband had said to him earlier that week, is it really kind of pushing him? Is it really necessary for her to go through, you know, a surgical biopsy? Shouldn't we be trying other things? And, you know, he was so almost affronted by the fact that my husband wanted to try different options first that he had to stick it to me. And I'll never forget, you know, the tears just
streaming down my face, and a nurse coming up to me and said, you know, sweetheart, you're going to be okay. I'm sorry that you had to experience this, because, you know, anyone in that room would have said, how could somebody be so insensitive? And so it became a little bit of a lot of a mission for me to simplify women's choices, healthcare choices, so that a woman would never have to deal with that again, by finding hospitals and healthcare providers that other women would highly recommend. And think about how many people would be spared that horrible, devastating experience. And also know that you're going to be with people who actually do care. You know, they care, because when you care, you know, nice matters. You know, it helps the healing process. It allows people to come to terms with things, illnesses, or situations, not just for themselves, but for their families. And it's important. And, you know, it's all part of what makes us want to go for these exams and screenings, or what turns us off and says, I'd rather not know, you know?
Sure. Now, by the way, let's take this a step farther. Men go through the exact same thing. Doctors talk to men that way also. And I really believe once you get to that point where you're frightened to death, you know, you've got something debilitating, you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, the doctor at that point is the be-all, end-all, quote-unquote, and they say something like that to you, you could have been John Wayne, and it would have been that same insulting slap, scary slap.
Absolutely.
In the face. Yeah, both ways.
Absolutely. That's a great point, Michael. You know, what we're trying to do is, when we say that we're identifying hospitals of choice for women and their families, we really mean that. It's not just for them. It's for their husbands. It's for their brothers. It's for their sons. It's for their fathers. It's for the entire, you know, family experience. But why we focus on women at Women Certified, we are the voice of the female consumer. And the reason why we're providing women this voice out there is because women do have different needs than men. They have different medical needs than men.
Yes.
They have different priority of needs. They have, for example, women want more talk time, you know, with a doctor. A guy, you know, men will come in, they like to hear from the doctor, but really they want the solution, you know. They don't spend as much time asking all the questions. They don't belabor a lot of the issues. They really want to get to the point, get to the solution. So, and male doctors tend to deliver information that way, too. They usually give you only, you know, 23 seconds of talk time before they'll interrupt you. So, you know, the males tend to be more direct. Women tend to want to talk it through. They want to build a relationship. They tend to need more of that, you know, nurturing bedside manner than men do. And so, you know, we know that she has that higher level of need. So we say, and actually we proved this through the Wharton School, where we did a joint study on gender consumer preferences.
Yeah.
And what we found is that when you meet the needs of women, you exceed those of men. So if we just find every doctor and hospital or business out there that's women friendly, they're going to exceed the expectations of men. Everyone will be happy.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let me, a quick personal story. Years ago, I was diagnosed with something, whatever, and I walked in, and the doctor, I knew I was in trouble when my ex and I walked into the doctor's office, and instead of sitting and waiting, the nurse said, he's right in there, and we walked into a room when everybody else is waiting, right? So he said, you have so-and-so, and I said, how do you fix it? And that's exactly what my response was, based on what you said exactly. Don't talk to me for 20 minutes. How do I get this thing fixed? And then we rocked, and I figured out how to do it. But the point is, you're absolutely right. It's the difference between talking to both genders is exactly that. Now, obviously, that's not in every case, but for the most part, you're spot on with that.
Right. Well, you know, it's going to be the case 60 to 70% of the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, every one of us has male and female tendencies. So some of us will be a little bit more direct. Some of us will spend more time. I have so many women saying, I must be a guy. I have so many guys saying, I must be more of a female. It's not that. It's just that we do carry female and male tendencies. But generalities, you know, are very clear. Those are the stereotypes. And stereotypes actually help us identify what, you know, common behaviors are. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, now I remember I was talking to the doctor, and he said, well, all right, we're going to check out here, and if this is a problem, we're going to have to wake you up, because you're going to have a real problem. Otherwise, we're going to do this and we're going to drain it out your side. I remember I came out of the ether, whatever it was, and I looked up at the nurse and I said, is there anything hanging out my side? And she said, yes. And I looked up at the sky. I said, thank you. And it went from there.
That's right. Exactly.
Little tube. You know, little tube.
But healthcare is very important. I mean, the right quality of care is very important for us. And it's not just about the clinical outline. You know, there are a lot of lists out there that focus on clinical outcomes. What we do at Women Certified is look at the patient and the customer experience. We're not just healthcare, you know, we're other industries, but, you know, we look at the very best in customer care, whether you're a patient or not, you're still a customer. And, you know, who are the brands, who are the hospitals, who are the healthcare providers that, you know, deliver that level of experience that you deserve. So, you know, like when you were in there, you know, you were really focused on the outcome, where for more women, they're focused on the total experience. The outcome is obviously the end result, which is what we're all seeking. But to get her there in a good, happy way takes a heck of a lot more.
No, by the way, and you're absolutely right. I remember when I was when they said who do you want to do the operation? That's where I was locally. And I said nobody here, and I found a place where they did it day in and day out and day in and day out. And I remember when they showed up for it, they put me on the gurney and they wheeled me down the hallway, and everybody was waiting in line, and I felt very comfortable because these were people who knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you know, you must have known about them through, you know, whether it's recommendations. Or, you know, you've heard about the really good, you know, you must have heard good things through the grapevine.
Recommendation, yeah. Today, there was a woman who lived four or five houses away from me who had been through the same process, and she said, go there. And that's how I got the recommendation. That's where I went.
Exactly. Do you know today that I just came back from a big conference in Vegas speaking, and one of the other keynoters said that in a recent study, and this is based on, you know, purchasing online, that 90% of customers value more the recommendations of others versus even somebody that they haven't met before, you know, looking at comments and stuff, than anything else. They value the recommendations and referrals of others than anything else. Only 14% of the brand's advertising impacts their decision to purchase or to make that decision. So that surgical center could have advertised day and night, but it took the woman down the street that you knew and you saw it, right, for you to make that choice. That's really where all these hospitals and businesses need to spend their money, not on, you know, billboards, but on promoting on the billboard why they could be trusted, because they earned a top spot as a top hospital among women by women. That's the type of stuff that they want to know about, you know. The consumer wants to know about the experience of others.
No question about it. And as a matter of fact, that's where the consumer lives through it. They actually get to see themselves through someone else's experience. And the best recommendation you can get is, quote unquote, someone who's been there and done that.
Right. And it doesn't matter. And interesting, they don't care whether they know you or not. It's called, you know, strangers with experience. So even if you didn't know the neighbor well, or even if you heard it was your, you know, she said to you, but, you know, my friend from work, I mean, it didn't matter. If you knew, if somebody went through the experience and had, you know, an objective position on it, that's what would compel you to make that decision. No difference if you're buying a pair of shoes. You know, we go on to Zappos or whatever, and we go on, we buy the shoes, but before we buy it, we go down and read the customer reviews, and we listen to the customer.
Yeah. No question about it. If anybody really wants to know, they normally, you know, obviously the company wants to, or whatever it is, let's call it the company, the product, the company wants you to buy from them, so we know that the company wants me to spend money, get the checkbook out, credit card, whatever. But if you're dealing with somebody who has spent money with that company and their end result turned out to be what they wanted, that's an entirely different story. Now you're talking to someone who does not have any kind of a vested interest in it. They're not going to make any money out of them telling you to go to a particular place. Now all of a sudden it's got a completely new, different feel to it.
Changing the way anybody is doing marketing and advertising. And as consumers, you know, it gives us the power because we're no longer, you know, watching a commercial or we're no longer just seeing a celebrity endorse something. Now we get to know what hundreds or thousands or potentially millions of people think about that brand or that experience. So, you know, it's only provided us more, you know, ammunition to make better choices. There's no excuse today not to make good choices.
You see, and actually what happened to you was one of the best things that probably happened to a lot of people. Had you not gone through that, you would not be doing what you're doing right now.
And, you know, thank you. And, Michael, what I think is really important is to let women and men understand that breast cancer is, you know, in many cases, it's curable. Actually, they say if you catch it early, it's like 95 to 98% curable. Yeah. When I went to my doctor, now it's almost 9 years, in January it'll be 9 years, and I remember the doctor saying, if you didn't, and this was a friend who said to me at 42, go for your baseline. I'm kind of young for that. I went anyway because she nudged me, and he said to me when I had my, you know, I had a mastectomy and I took care of it, he said, you know, basically you're cured. You know, we're going to give you a chemo because for insurance, make sure there's nothing little stragglers in your body, but you consider yourself cured. And, you know, that was like music to my ears, but I want women out there and men too, because there's about 2,000 cases a year about for men with breast cancer. So it's not just a female disease, but it's a primarily, obviously a female disease, that they can't fear this disease. What they have to fear is ignorance, right? Now they have to fear don't fear the unknown, because knowledge is so powerful. Anything you catch early enough today is curable practically. So, you know, you hope that you get there early and, you know, then you can take care of it. And I do want to share though, don't worry if you get there at a later stage, because there are so many things out there too that are very aggressive against breast cancer and increasing survival rates significantly. But obviously the earlier you go, the better your chances. And you could live your life and just chalk it up to another bump in the road, but one that'll, you know, make you see life a little differently. It's not such a negative for us. For me, it was a very positive. So, you know, look at the bright side of things.
Yeah, we're just about out of time, but two things, Delia. One is, I want to make sure that we get this point out. You said it, 2,000 men a year. Men get breast cancer also, so it's not specifically a woman's disease. Now, the other thing is, where do we find you? Website where we can get more information. And
thank you.
Book.
Yes, please go to womencertified.com. So that's WOMEN. Certified, all one word, womencertified.com. And then on there you will see our referral directory, which will have the map of the United States and Canada, and you'll be able to click each state and see which hospitals are the top hospitals in your state. You'll also be able to, you'll see that there's a list as well as of all the hospitals. And I encourage all of your listeners, especially the females, to sign up for our Women Certified panel so they too could share in these phenomenal surveys that allow us to then select businesses of choice that other women could use and appreciate.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure as always, and thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. We'll be right back.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dana Micucci with us. She is the author of Sojourns of the Soul, One Woman's Journey Around the World and Into Her Truth. She was fascinated with writing the word as she at a very young age, and a very early obsession with children's stories books led to juvenile attempts to penning prose and poetry, and eventually to a compulsive stalking of bookstores. And after receiving her BA and MA in English Lit from Northwestern University, she indulged in a long-held fantasy to live as a bohemian writer in a garret of her own in the Left Bank of Paris. And let's stop there and we can move forward. Dana, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. That must have been fun.
Yes, it was fun. I don't know what to say, Michael. That was just part of the journey early on, and I, I've always been a free spirit, and I've always kind of set out into uncertain zones to just basically explore, and really, the whole quest and the quest that I write about in my book, Sojourns of the Soul, is really one of self-knowledge that we all can take, and that many of us do.
Now, by the way, obviously you've been around a lot, going to Paris and coming back to New York and mm-hmm. doing a lot of the things that you did. But did the truth change? When I say did the truth change, obviously you can go, you can search, you can discover, you can get underneath the surface of so many things. But when it really comes down to it, doesn't matter where you are. It's that one look in the mirror, that aha, oh wow, that's it moment, that we discover ourselves. Where did you discover your truth? Where did you discover who you truly were?
Ah, well, that's an ongoing process.
Sure.
But I would say probably I had my biggest revelation in my late 20s. And that's when I really set out very seriously on a quest for wisdom and truth, like many truth seekers throughout the ages have done. And, timeless, it's called the perennial wisdom. And I reached a point where I felt that I had to cross a threshold, and I had a choice, at least to me, it was presented to me this way, as a choice between, living a fairly secure life, fairly predictable, always knowing when my next paycheck would be there, versus a life of uncertainty and adventure. And we all make many, many choices. And for me, this is the choice that I made. And I decided in my late 20s that I wanted to be a freelance writer, and that as long as I was going to freelance, I may as well be, quote, free as possible. And so I decided to venture out into the world in search of these timeless truths and wisdom, only to realize, like many of us do, that the real destination was within myself. So I would say that, that really first awakening happened in my late 20s. I just turned 50 this year, and I say it's an ongoing search because on the Temple of Delphi are inscribed the words, "Know thyself," and that is an infinite, ever-expanding process, which brings great joy and also brings us many, many challenges. So it's a journey that is not for an exclusive few. It's one that we all can take and must take if we want to become whole, fully actualized beings. And in my particular case, because I was a journalist and I was able, I had a certain amount of freedom as a freelancer. I decided that I wanted to conduct my quest outside in the world in far-flung, exotic, sacred destinations, but and closer to home, it's ongoing. So I guess I want to say is that you don't have to travel to Tibet or Angkor Wat or Egypt, some of the destinations I write about, to really embark on that journey to know yourself.
In all of those places that you've been, did you find, and I'm going to say spiritually now, did you find an overarching theme? Did you find a commonality, something that was underneath everything that you found with everybody that you've talked to? Is there one
yes.
thing? What was
Michael,
it?
That is such an excellent question. And it's yes, I write about this in the book, that there were so many of the same teachings and lessons that came to me. And just to give your listeners some background, in the book, I take readers on 7 different journeys to sacred destinations throughout the world that occupied me for 14 years of my life. Many of them were on assignment as a journalist. Some of them were more personal missions. And the single most salient theme was that of transformation. And that was a transformation of the self at the deepest level, where I was challenged to strip away, release any previously held limiting beliefs and perceptions that really kept me from stepping in to my true divine essence and power, which we all have. And so the journeys that I chose had the most powerful effect on me. And I take readers from the Australian outback, where I was on an assignment to write about the ancient rock art of the Aborigines and exploring caves and various very remote landscapes all throughout Australia, from the Kimberley region to Arnhem Land to the Bush to Ayers Rock. And then I take readers to Angkor in Cambodia, where I was on an assignment to write about the preservation efforts of Angkor Wat with an international preservation group, to Egypt, where I worked with Kenneth Weeks, an American archaeologist who discovered the KV5 tomb and had been quite a bit in the media at that time. So I wrote about that discovery and crawled into the tomb with him, among many other adventures. And then to Tibet, to the sacred Mayan lands in New Mexico, in Mexico in the Yucatan. I have then I take readers to New Mexico, where I now live after 22 years in Manhattan, and finally to Peru. So just to give them a background on the various sacred destinations. And so I started talking about this theme of transformation, and that did come to me in many of the same lessons and teachings. And I would say that throughout all of these, I learned how to really connect and understand deeply this sacred web of connection between all life forms, Mother Earth, and the cosmos. Another lesson that kept coming repeatedly was to just, how do I become fully present in the moment, letting go of all desired outcomes, how I think things should be or evolve? I was really challenged and gifted with many opportunities that allowed me to become more present, I believe, than I had ever been. And another lesson that kept revisiting me, and the Aborigines were masters at this, as are many of our indigenous cultures, including the Native Americans and the Peruvian shamans that I visited with and worked with in Peru in the Amazon, is this learning how to truly integrate the many dualities that we face all the time on this earth plane, whether we're exploring a far-flung sacred place or we're in our own backyard. And, the pendulum swing between being and doing and feeling and thinking, spirit and matter, the sacred and the sensual, where oftentimes we find ourselves at one extreme or the other. And I found that many of my experiences through these journeys helped me to come to a kind of a center point, to a balance, to be able to balance these extremes within myself. And I realized that this is a necessary requirement on the path to conscious awareness, spiritual evolution, to be able to integrate all of these dualities. And then there were always these momentary glimpses into eternity, into this eternal now, and my heart would just felt so expanded in a way that it had never felt before. And I guess I can only describe that feeling as one of unconditional love, a kind of a universal versus particular love. And this came to me in many beautiful packages, whether it was in Angkor, where I walked with a young Cambodian architecture student whose families had been annihilated by the Khmer Rouge, and walking and witnessing the killing fields in this scorched, war-torn country, and having to go deeply into my own shadow side and a lot of the emotions that came up for me while experiencing this. And ultimately, many of these journeys, and including the one in Tibet, were in a very similar way, witnessing the harsh realities of the Tibetans under the oppression of the Chinese, you know, just took me deeper and deeper into my heart, into areas of love and forgiveness that really are the only answer most of the time, all of the time, I believe.
You know, it's analogous to all that. I'm listening very closely to you. And what I hear, and I really believe the thing that stops the connection, the balance, the homeostasis is something called resistance. And we resist only because we've been taught to be a particular way. You let that way go, and it's frightening for so many people. And I would, as an analogy, I see what's going on in this country right now. Whatever way it's going to turn out, I don't even think we're dealing with right, wrong, who's better, who's worse, whatever. I think we're looking at a tremendous amount of resistance. And there'll be an explosion, quote unquote, emotionally, physically, and then once it stops, I don't mean a bomb, but there'll be an explosion
right
through the culture, and then once it settles down and people stop resisting, they'll be able to see whatever their truth is. Resistance stops truth, and there are too many people. And you mentioned about living in the present. Too many people are living 10 minutes ahead, 20 minutes behind. And they just don't realize what's going on now. You blink your, you know, you snap your finger, and I'll bet any amount of money, if you think about it, you were just in high school.
Yes, you know, that is so true, Michael. And I also write about that in the book. And resistance, the opposite of resistance, is surrender. And I found myself in many situations where I had to simply surrender to what was in front of me, some of them dangerous situations that were unexpected. When I went to Cambodia, Pol Pot had just fallen from power. The Khmer Rouge was still active in the area around Siem Reap, where I was staying near Angkor Wat. There were landmines everywhere. Malaria was rampant. It was just, you know, I had to ask myself many times, as friends and family did, what on earth? I'm not a political correspondent. You know, I was just there. I wasn't a war correspondent. I was just there writing about culture. And yet there were so many things that threatened to throw me off center. Worries, doubts, fears, these are our shadows, and we all have them. And I think one of all of our greatest challenge is simply to move beyond those, to find that center point, as you say, to not resist. And there is a cliche, but it's true, what you resist persists.
Sure.
And so a huge lesson, huge, was this process of surrendering and letting go. And I realized that as each journey propelled me into higher levels of awareness, and this is ongoing, and it happens to all of us. You know, I was just, this because of my work, I was able to go out and be in these far-flung places. But I realized that these are initiations, and that these initiations are required for spiritual growth, and also require an active engagement on our part through intention to realize our fullest potential and to surrender and not resist the process. So, yes.
Yeah, I won't go through the whole thing, but there's something that I got years and years and years ago, and I have no idea where this came from, and it says found on a refrigerator in Toronto, and the author was unknown, and it was Rules for Being Human, and it goes through the process of the rules. And number nine is your answers lie inside of you, and the answers of life questions lie inside of you. All you need to do is look, listen, and trust. But number 10 is the most important of all, and you're going to forget all of it. until the next one comes up, and then you move through it. I really believe that life is nothing more than one lesson after another. And I've got that loud and clear, because when it comes up, was okay, must have cleared something, so where's the next one? It never stops. And when you get that, it's okay.
That's so true. It never stops. And you think that, well, wow, I had this realization, and now I have this wisdom. Well, guess what? There's another lesson around the corner. And as long as you're willing, and we're all able to do this, it comes from intention, if we're will and devotion, and if we're willing to step on that path of uncertainty and to become vulnerable and to learn the lessons and to process our shadow sides and all of this, it's work, you know, and it's disciplined inner work. I'll never forget one of my journeys. One of the chapters takes me and the readers into, as I mentioned, the sacred Mayan sites of the Yucatan. And on that journey, I was on a pilgrimage with Hunbutsmen, a Mayan elder and daykeeper, and there were about 20 of us in the group, and we would meet in the mornings and discuss Mayan cosmology and astronomy, and were they masters of consciousness. And then we would go out into these sacred sites and learn various healing, Mayan healing techniques and various rituals and ceremonies. And the biggest message, and in that chapter, my subtitle is Initiation. And there I was initiated, really, into the knowledge of myself as a spark of the divine, which we all are. But we, you know, Nelson Mandela said that it's not our darkness, our dark side that most scares us. It's our light. And he said, you know, your playing small does not serve the world. And the way for us to continue to expand our light and live in our light and be
Let me hold you up. We're starting to run out of time. But yeah. I want to leave you with this, with everything that you've said. And let me get your website first, and I want to leave you with something. Where can we find you, and where can we find your work in the books?
You can find my books on questbooks.net, the book Sojourns of the Soul, and you can find them on Amazon and in bookstores, and my website is www.danimacucci.com.
Wonderful. Now, let me give you this very quickly. Two things. One is on those rules for being human, and when I finally got this, the world turned around. And it says others are merely mirrors of you. You can't love, you can't hate something about another person unless it reflects to you something you love or hate about yourself. And the other one is there was a psychic on some months back, and the one he left with, it was a quote he had. He said, people always ask me what happens after you die. And he said, I ask them, what happens when you finally live? And with that, Dana, we got to go, and I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Michael. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.